decays. We discussed the tree level decays already. Now we're going to go to the one loop decays. And the one in particular we're going to talk about is Higgs to two gluons. As I mentioned last class, this decay is very difficult to look for, if not impossible, just because there's lots of gluons around in hadronic collisions. But this process is actually very important for producing the Higgs. You can produce it through inverse decays, where you have two gluons producing the Higgs. So that is actually going to be the dominant way that the Higgs will be produced at the Large Hadron Collider. So that's why this is very useful. So here's what we're going to compute. We want to compute the decay of Higgs to two gluons. And so let's start by writing down the matrix element. And there's two diagrams to consider. So I'll divide them up into M1 plus M2, where you have the two diagrams. The first diagram looks like this. Where this is a top loop in the middle. So we have two gluons where I have, let's say, the color indices are A and B, and the Lorentz indices are mu and nu. And then I have another diagram where I just cross the legs. Oops, this. And T, 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 and then I have the gluons going out like this. This is G, A, mu, G, B, nu. All right, so I have two diagrams. In principle, you could have any quark inside the loop, but it'll turn out that the top will give us the largest contribution, of course, because it has the largest coupling to the Higgs. So that's what, and we'll see. We'll see also what the contribution from the lighter quarks is as well. So let me label the momenta. So T, so I'll write this as momentum K. This will be momentum Q going in this way. So this is K plus Q. This will be momentum P1 and P2. So this is K plus P. Oh, wait, I call them P and P prime. So let me stick to that. P prime. And this is K plus P prime going down that way. All right. The other thing to notice that's important is that the Higgs can't decay directly to TT bar because it's not allowed kinematically. But this process is probing indirectly the coupling of the Higgs to the top quark. So even though we can't measure directly, we're probing it indirectly at one loop. So let's compute the matrix element, M1. We have to do a momentum integral. So I'll write that as d dk over 2 pi to the d. When we compute this diagram, it's going to be finite. But there's actually a subtle cancellation that occurs. And you have to compute it using dim reg to see that this cancellation occurs. Actually, if you try to compute it in four dimensions, you'll actually end up getting the wrong answer. So you have to compute it in dim reg, even though the answer will be finite eventually. You'll see what happens. It's a subtle effect. So we're doing the integral in d dimensions. So now let's write down the rest of the matrix elements. We have a closed fermion loop, so that's a minus 1. And then we have to do the trace. All right, so let's go through the fermion line. I have an I k slash plus mt over k squared minus mt squared. That's this. And then I have this vertex, which is I strong coupling gamma nu, and then the generator for SU3 color with the index b. Then I have this propagator, so it's I. I'll write this up here. And then it's k slash plus p prime slash plus mt over k plus p prime squared minus mt squared. Then I have the other vertex from here, I strong coupling gamma mu ta. And then I have the last propagator, which is I k slash plus q slash plus mt over k plus q squared minus mt squared. Oh, need that. And then I have the last vertex, which was here, the Higgs vertex. So that is minus I mt over v. And that's the trace of everything. Then the last part is I just need to put in the polarization vectors for the outgoing gluons. So that's epsilon mu of p and epsilon nu of p prime. Wait, I think it's actually epsilon star. I forget. Outgoing, I think, has to be a star. Is that right? Yeah, I think that's true. OK, so here's the matrix element. Let me just simplify it. So I have minus, so all of the minuses in the i's. Let's see, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 i's. And then we have 2 minuses, so we get a net minus sign. We have gs squared trace. The trace is going not only over the Lorentz indices, or the Dirac indices, I should say. It also goes over the color indices as well, since we're summing over all possible colors in the loop. So I want to take the trace of these generators, TA, TB. Now I have this factor of MT over the VEV. I have the polarization vectors, epsilon mu, P star, epsilon nu, P prime star. And then I have the integral, d dk, 2 pi to the d. And then I have a trace of k slash plus mt, gamma nu, k slash plus p slash prime, mt, gamma mu, and then k slash plus q plus mt, and that's it. And then all of this is divided by the denominator, which is k squared minus mt squared, k plus p prime squared minus mt squared, and k plus q squared minus mt squared. OK, so this is what we're going to compute. And we're going to evaluate different terms as we go. All right, so the first thing that we want to do is use Feynman parameters to reevaluate the denominator in a more useful way. So I can write the this matrix element M1 as minus GS squared trace TA TB MT over V, epsilon mu, epsilon nu, star. And then we have this integral. Let me do the Feynman parameters. So integrating over dx, dy, dz. I have a 2, delta 1 minus x minus y minus z. And then I have the momentum integral, d to the k over 2 pi d. And then I have the trace over all this stuff that I had in the previous line. And then the denominator, of course, looks nicer. It's k squared minus mt squared x plus k plus p prime squared minus mt squared y plus k plus q squared minus mt squared z cubed. OK. So now we have to go through the usual steps for evaluating this integral. The first thing you want to do is recast the denominator in terms of something that looks simpler. So let's just worry about the denominator. So we have k squared minus mt squared x plus k plus p prime squared minus mt squared y plus k plus q squared minus mt squared z. And we can write this as k squared times x plus y plus z is all just equal to 1. We have 2 times k dot yp prime plus zq. Then we have plus p prime squared y squared plus q squared z. Oh, sorry, it's just yz. And we have minus mt squared. All right, so expanding everything, this is what we get. P prime squared is just equal to 0, since it's the gluon momentum. And then q squared is just equal to mh squared. So now what we want to do is complete the square. So we have k plus yp prime plus zq squared. And we need to subtract off the stuff that we added to complete the square. So that's y squared p prime squared, which is just equal to 0. And then we have a minus z squared q squared. And then we have the cross term, which is minus 2 p prime dot q yz. And then we have this, which is plus mh squared z and minus mt squared. OK. So you can rewrite all of this in the following form. This is equal to some other momentum L squared minus some mass squared, where this is a function of x and z, where L is equal to just everything I have here, k plus y p prime plus zq, and m squared is equal to mt squared minus xz mh squared. That's what you end up getting when you simplify everything. So to get that, we had to express this in terms of q squared, which you'll probably know how to do. It's just you just use p prime dot q is equal to p prime dot p plus p prime. And so that's just equal to p dot p prime, since p prime squared is 0. And so this is actually just equal to 1 half times q squared, or 1 half mh squared. And then you also have to use the relation that x plus y plus z is equal to 1. Bless you. OK, and so here's what we get. So now what we want to do is evaluate the trace First, we want to substitute in, we want to re-express k in the trace in terms of L, and then we just expand the trace. So it's pretty simple. I'll just tell you what you get. So we set k is equal to L minus yp prime minus zq, and plug it into the trace. And here's what you get. You get 16 times mt times L mu L nu minus 4 mt squared L squared eta mu nu plus 4 mt cubed eta mu nu minus 2 mt mh squared 1 minus 2 xz eta mu nu, and then you get plus 4 1 minus 4 xz p1 nu p2, oops, sorry, I should be using p and p prime, p nu p prime mu times mt. So that's what you get. I had to throw away some of the terms, which end up not contributing. It's straightforward what to do. So I threw away terms that are linear in L. Because once I write the denominator like this, the integral is, or I should say this part of the integral, the denominator part is symmetric with respect to L goes to minus L. And so any term in the numerator that's odd under L goes to minus L will vanish. So I can throw away terms linear in L. I also can throw away terms with P mu or P prime nu. Since those will be contracted with the corresponding polarization vectors, which will just give 0, so we don't need those terms either. We only need p nu, p prime mu, or eta mu nu, or l mu nu terms. So that's all we need. So putting all of those pieces together, we have this matrix element is minus g squared trace of ta tb. Mt squared over v. All of these terms have at least one power of mt, so I get an mt squared. I have epsilon mu star epsilon nu star. And now I'm left with the Feynman parameter integral, dx, dy, dz, 2 times delta 1 minus x minus y minus z. And then I have to do the momentum integral. And I have the denominator, which is 1 over L squared minus M squared cubed. Then I have everything in the numerator, which is there's a 16 minus 4 over D. Oh, I forgot one other thing. There's another thing I want to do, which I can also rewrite L mu L nu in terms of L squared eta mu nu. So this is another substitution I can do. So I can set this equal to 1 over d times L squared eta mu nu. Is that familiar? The reason I can do that is because I'm integrating over L, and so actually it doesn't depend on the direction at all. And so once I do this integral, whatever I'm integrating with respect to has to be proportional to eta mu nu, because that's the only object that is symmetric and has two Lorentz indices. So I can just replace the L mu L nu with an L squared times eta mu nu. The only thing I don't know is the coefficient, which I can fix just by contracting both sides with eta mu nu. Eta mu nu times this would just be equal to L squared. And eta mu nu contracted into this would just give you D times L squared times 1 over D. So that fixes the coefficient. It's just a property of symmetry. Okay. So I can relate this term. I can convert it to an L squared term, which looks very similar to this, except I have a factor of 1 over D floating around, which is why I have this. Sorry, I did this wrong. This is 16 over D minus 4. Okay. And then I have L squared, eta mu nu. Yeah, I factored, this should only be MT, sorry about that. So I factored out the MT to give you MT squared. Before I just had MT over VEV. So I factored that out. So this term is obviously this one, and then this one is just the 16 divided by D. So it's just this term here. Okay, now let's put in the other terms. So I have plus 2 mt squared minus mh squared times 1 minus 2xz, eta mu nu. And then I have 4, 1 minus 4xz, p nu p prime mu. Okay, and that's it. Yeah, sure. So it's because I have the polarization vectors for the gluon. So epsilon mu would always get contracted with p mu if I have a p mu term here. And so epsilon dot p is just equal to 0. And similarly, epsilon for the other gluon contracted into p prime will also be equal to 0. The same thing as in a QED. All right. So I have these momentum integrals to do. You can see already that when I set d equal to 4, this will give you a term that's like 4 minus 4, which will be 0, right? But this term gives you a divergent integral. And so this is kind of a subtle term that we have to worry about, keeping track of exactly how it scales as d goes to 4. So this will end up giving us something that's finite as d goes to 4. So let's write down what the momentum integrals are, and we'll see how this works. So we have to do integral number 1, which is d dl over 2 pi to the d L squared over L squared minus M squared cubed. And I'm assuming that you know how to evaluate integrals like this, right? Is that true? OK, Dan's nodding, but maybe the rest of you might want to chime in. OK, I'll assume so. So maybe it's not a good assumption. But anyway, to evaluate a loop integral like this, you can look it up in the appendix in Peskin and Schroeder, what it is. So it ends up being minus I over 4 pi d over 2, d over 2, gamma 3 minus d over 2 minus 1 over gamma 2. And then there's 1 over m squared, 3 minus d over 2 minus 1. So again, I don't know if this is familiar, but if you wanted to do this, you're basically just doing this integral. And what you do is you Euclideanize the momentum. So you just say L0 goes to I times L0. And then you can just do the integral, basically, in spherical coordinates and d dimensions. And this is what you get as the expression. So I don't think there's no deep reason why it is what it is. It just is that. The other integral we want to do is has a slightly different form. It's ddl 2 pi d 1 over l squared minus m squared cubed. And this is I over 4 pi d over 2 gamma of 3 minus d over 2 over gamma 3. Sorry, this should be a 3 here. And then I have 1 over m squared to the power of 3 minus d over 2. And again, the other important thing to point out, if this is not quite familiar, is that, remember, some integrals are going to give us divergences as the momentum cutoff goes to infinity. And in dim reg, those divergences are represented by where the gamma function goes to infinity. So remember, the gamma function of 0 or any negative integer goes to infinity. And so that, if that is the case, it will give us a divergence. So this integral is obviously finite. You can see that just by looking at the momentum dependence. As d goes to 4, it's just d4l over l to the 6, which will give us something finite. This one is not finite because it looks like d4l over l to the 4, which will have a log divergence. And so here, gamma of 3 minus 2, when I set d equal to 4, will just be gamma of 1, which is just equal to 1. So there's no divergence as d goes to 4. But here, obviously, there is, because when d goes to 4, I get gamma of 0, which is infinity. All right. So integral 1 is divergent. But actually, we only need to keep the divergent part of this integral because it's multiplying something which goes to 0 as d goes to 4. Yeah, seriously. So we only need to compute the divergent part of this integral here. So let's worry about that. So integral 1, we only need the divergent part. It's 1. Minus I over 16 pi squared. Times, so that's what I get when I set d equal to 4 here. And then I get d over 2, so I need to keep the d, so I'll keep that as d over 2. Now I have gamma of 3 is just a 1 half, or I should say a 2. So it looks like a 1 half. And then I have gamma of 2 minus d over 2. So gamma of 2 minus d over 2. And then that's it. So as d goes to 4 here, that's just going to give us 1. So we don't need to care about that one. So the other thing we want to know is how do we represent gamma as d goes to 4? So you just use the identity that gamma of x is equal to 1 over x plus finite terms as x goes to 0. So this is just equal to, so again, I can just set d equal to 4 here because it's not going to be divergent. But I have, actually, let me just keep the d dependence here because it'll be simpler. So I have minus I over 16 pi squared d over 2, d over 4. And then I have so this is 4. Minus 2d over 2, so I get a 2 divided by 4 minus, 2 minus d over 2 is 4, yeah, just this, sorry, 4 minus d, like that, plus finite terms. Okay, so that's one term. Now let's do the second term. So again, we can just set d equal to 4 from the outset because it's finite. And what you get is 1 over 16 pi squared, 1 half, and then 1 over m squared. So plugging everything in, we have I times m1 is equal to minus I over 16 pi squared, gs squared, the trace of ta, tb. We have mt squared over v. We have epsilon mu star, epsilon nu star. We still have the Feynman parameter integrals, so I'll just write that as, so nothing in the integrand depends on y. So I'll just do the y integral using the delta function. And so I'm just left with two integrals remaining, the integral over x and the integral over z. So I have an integral over x, let's say, from 0 to 1, and an integral over z from 0 to 1 minus x. And now I have all of this stuff. I'm just going to plug in these integrals. And what I get is minus 4 times 4 minus d over d. So that's this first factor. I've just factored out a 4 and written it over a common denominator. And now I can plug in this expression for the integral. I have d2 over 4 minus d times 2 for the factor of, wait, let's see. Yeah, let me think. D over 4. I think I'm missing a factor of 2. I don't remember. Okay, let's see. So I have D over 4. So this is, okay, so I have 4 minus d over d, that's this term, and I factored out a 4, and I have a minus sign in front, sure, okay, and then I have d 2 over 4 minus d, and then I have a factor of 2, where did this one come from? In front of the what? Oh, the delta function. Yeah, great. Thank you. Thank you. Great. Yeah, so right. This was from the in front of the delta function. Perfect. Okay. And then all of that is multiplying eta mu nu. Oh, I forgot one thing. Oh, this minus sign? So I have a minus sign here.
But you took minus sign. Oh, no.
But it also had a minus sign in front of there, too. Is that right? I think it's correct. So there's a minus sign there, and there's a minus sign here. And so the whole thing should be positive, I think. I think that's correct. And then the last thing I need to include is d over 4. Oh, yeah, d over 4. OK, I just set that equal to 1. Because the deviation from that will just contribute to terms that will vanish as d goes to 4. All right, so I think this is right. And then I just have, I think that's it. Eta mu nu. That's all? Yeah, I think that's it. Okay. So then the next term I have is, yeah, I'm not sure why I wrote it. I wrote it kind of weird in my notes. But I think that's right. All right.
Wait a second.
So, oh wait, this is this term. No. So I have this. I'm kind of confused about this. Okay, well, let me try to figure this out. So then the next set of terms is we have 2 times 2mt squared minus mh squared. Oh wait, yeah, no, it's the, there's something wrong with the dimensions. L squared. Oh, okay. Yeah, okay, sorry about this. Right, let's see. 3 minus 2 minus 1. Yeah, okay, sorry about that. Okay. I did a step in my idea. I did a step that I didn't write down explicitly. So what I want to do, yeah, sorry about the confusion. Okay, before I get to that term, what I'm going to do is in the second term, when I do the momentum integral, when I set d equal to 4, I'll get a term like 1 over m squared. And so all I'm going to do is factor out a 1 over m squared out front explicitly. So I just have a 1 over m squared out here. Okay. So now if I factor this term out front, because this term here from integral 1 doesn't have that, I need to include that factor here. So that's what I had in my notes that was confusing. So I have mt squared minus xz mh squared, like this. Okay, so that makes more sense. So this is m squared, and so this is just m squared over m squared, which is just 1. So that term, so that explains that. All right, so now we'll do the next terms. And what I get, I'll just write down the answer, 4 mt squared minus 2 mh squared plus 4 xz times mh squared, 8 mu nu. And then the last term is I have plus 4, 1 minus 4 xz times p nu p prime mu. Okay. Sorry about the confusion. So without going through the algebra, when you plug in momentum integral 2 and do these integrals, I claim this is what you get.
Is the final term of the gamma function goes to 0 as x goes to 0?
As x goes to 0, so as d goes to 4, the finite terms will go to 0 because they will always multiply this expression of 4 minus d. So that's sort of the logic. We only need to keep the divergent terms because everything, all of the finite terms are multiplying something that goes to 0 as d goes to 4. So that's the argument. But you can see that it was very important that we keep the divergent part because it multiplies something that goes to 0, and so it'll give us something that's finite. It'll give us a finite contribution to this integral. Okay. So, we'll cancel out some stuff. So this will cancel this. And then this 4 can cancel this d, like that. And so we can simplify it. And here's what we get. We get I times the matrix element is minus I over the square over 16 pi squared gs squared, the trace of ta tb. And then we have mt squared over the vev epsilon mu star epsilon nu star. Then we have a factor of 4 p mu, p nu p prime mu minus 2 mh squared eta mu nu. And then the whole thing is multiplying this Feynman parameter integral, the x dz. This integral of 1 minus 4 xz over mt squared minus xz mh squared. Okay. Now what I'm going to do is factor out the mt squared from the denominator here, and it'll cancel the mt squared here of the numerator. So I'll just do that here. I can write this as a 1, and I can write this as a 1 divided by mt squared. Now we can do this integral. It's possible to do this integral for any value of Higgs mass and top mass, and you can write it in a closed form. But it's kind of complicated to do, and it's not particularly illuminating. So let's just take the limit that the top mass is very, very heavy. So we'll just consider this limit. That the top mass is much, much greater than the Higgs mass. Of course, this is not really satisfied. But it actually works well fairly numerically when you actually do this. So it's not so bad, even though you might be concerned. So I'll just say it's OK. Even if the top mass is around the Higgs mass, it still works pretty well. So in this case, we can do this integral very easily. We just have an integral like this, 1 minus 4xz. And that's just equal to 1/3. So once I take this limit, I can just throw away this extra term in the denominator, and I can just do the integral simply. All right. So here's what we get at the end of the day. The matrix element, the full matrix element, so diagram 1 plus diagram 2. It turns out that diagram 2 it gives you exactly the same answer as diagram 1. And you can see that just because the only difference is it flips P and P prime, and it flips all the indices. But this is symmetric with respect to all of the indices and P and P prime once you flip all of those things together. So it should give you just a factor of 2, which it does. So I'll just write this as 2 times I times M1. And what you get is this is just minus I alpha s over 3 pi times the vev epsilon mu of p epsilon nu of p prime. And then we have p nu p prime mu minus mh squared over 2 eta mu nu. And then the trace over the generators just gives us 1/2 delta AB. So that's what we get. So I have a 1/2. So I have delta AB, and then the 1/2 will cancel out this 2 here. So that's the end result for the matrix element. All right, so now we can compute the decay rate. It's pretty simple. So first, what we want to do is compute the sum over the matrix element squared. So that's just alpha s over 3 pi times the VEV squared. We have delta AB, delta AB. And then we have P nu, P prime mu minus MH squared over 2 eta mu nu. And then it's contracted with P nu, P prime mu minus MH squared over 2 eta mu nu. So this sum here, remember there are 8 gluons. So this will just give us a factor of 8. And all of this stuff here will end up giving us MH to the fourth over 2. I think that's right. You can check it. All right. So we can just use the same formula that we had before. There's no need to divide by anything when you're averaging over the initial states, of course, because the Higgs is just a scalar. It doesn't have any spin. So using the same formula that we had before for the two-body matrix element, let me just write down what that was. It's just 1 over 16 pi times MH, and then sum over the matrix element squared. And then once we plug in everything, what we get is that this is equal to alpha S squared MH cubed divided by 64 pi cubed times the VEV squared. So that's what we get at the end of the day. That's the results. And oh, there's one other thing which we needed to put in, which is that you have to divide by 2 because the gluons are just identical. So I should write in an extra 1/2 here. All right, so when you plug in, what you get is this is around 0.23 MeV, which would end up being around 5.7% of the branching ratio. But I told you it was a bit larger. Actually, QCD corrections enhance this by a factor of 60%, I should say. So when you include higher order diagrams in alpha S, it gets enhanced by around 60%. Yeah.
Delta AB, when you contact delta AB, you're summing over the final gluon states as well.
Sorry, say that again?
Are we summing over the final gluon states as well in this case?
Mm-hmm.
Can we control, I mean, GG where we get in the finite state, we sum between some v1s, right? Why do we have to sum over all v1s in the finite state?
Oh, yeah. So it's just summing over. You're assuming that you have two gluons in the final state, and you're only summing over the gluon degrees of freedom. So the colors of the gluon, which is why we got this 8 here, because there's 8 different gluon colors. And we're also summing over the gluon polarizations, which is we use this relation that epsilon mu epsilon nu summed over polarization gives us minus eta mu nu. It's a standard thing from like QED. And so we're summing over the gluon degrees of freedom. Now you might say, okay, gluons are not free states, right? So you don't have free gluons. They will hadronize, of course. But we're using this assumption of factorization implicitly that we're effectively saying that we're effectively computing the decay rate for Higgs to two gluons and then to go to any hadronic final state. And so because we're summing over all possible hadronic states, that probability will just be equal to 1. And so we can just compute the parton level process, which is what we did. Any other questions on this? OK. One thing you might notice is that all of the MT dependence canceled out. So it actually doesn't depend on MT at all. There was a cancellation between the Higgs coupling, which was MT in the Higgs coupling in the numerator, and MT, which entered into computing the loop integrals. So one thing you might ask is, given that it doesn't depend at all on MT, should we have included other quarks as well, even the lighter ones, since it doesn't depend on their mass?
But the fact that it doesn't depend on MT is just because we expanded that denominator over there, right?
Yeah, that's right. So
you kind of depend on MT because it doesn't depend on MT. I mean, just because it's the largest quark mass we have.
Yeah, so we implicitly assumed that MT was much larger than the Higgs in order to remove the MT dependence. But now, if you're not in that limit, like let's say we're considering a lighter quark, that would, of course, be a bad approximation. And so the question we should ask is, what does this integral look like if the Higgs is actually much heavier than the quark in the loop? So I'll just write down some approximate expressions. So we wanted to do this, 1 minus 4xz over 1 minus xz of mh squared over, I'll just call it mq squared. And OK, in the limit that mq is much larger than the Higgs, which is the case for top, what we got is that this is 1/3. And then if it's much, much lighter than the Higgs, then what you get is something like 1/2 mq squared over mh squared times log squared mh squared over mq squared plus other terms. This is just the leading term in the limit that mq goes to 0. And so this is the and for the other case, where mq is much lighter than the Higgs. So OK, this term obviously goes to 0 when mq goes to 0. So the dependence on the quark mass won't cancel out, and we'll get something that's suppressed. So I think the bottom contribution relative to the top contribution is something like somewhere between like 1 and 10%. I don't remember exactly what it is. But then, of course, for much lighter quarks, it's utterly negligible. And you don't need to include those things. Okay. So we did this loop calculation. What I want to do, and I guess we'll have to finish this next week, is talk about something called the low energy theorem for the Higgs. I'll just write it up here. So we went through all of these steps for computing the Higgs to gluon coupling, by computing the loop integral explicitly. But there's kind of a nice way to do it, which relies on the beta function of QCD. It turns out that the coupling of the Higgs to two gluons is totally fixed just in terms of the beta function in a particular limit. So let me just write out what I mean. So the HGG coupling in the MT goes to infinity limit is fixed by the T contribution to the QCD beta function. So let me just write out what the answer is, and then we'll have to derive it on Monday. I computed the matrix element. Start out by saying, didn't write that down. OK. So if I consider the beta function of QCD, so the QCD beta function, which would just be d alpha s by d log mu, this is equal to minus 11 minus 2/3 times the number of fermion flavors times alpha s squared over 2 pi. Okay? So I can think of one thing, which is what is the top contribution to this beta function? And OK, I can just look at, for one fermion flavor, the top contribution to that beta function. Is beta s of t. So that would just be, the 2's would cancel out. And so I'll just have alpha s squared divided by 3 pi. The 11? Oh, that comes from the contribution from the gluon self-energy. Yeah, so I'm only talking about the contribution to the beta function from the top. So it's only it's only relevant for considering this theorem. Yeah. So I computed the matrix element for coupling the Higgs to two gluons. And I can think of that as an effective interaction between the Higgs and two gluons. So I can write that as, HGG as an effective interaction. In the MT goes to infinity limit with the following coefficients. So the effective interaction would be alpha s over 6 pi times the VEV, h times the trace of g mu nu, g mu nu. So what I mean by an effective interaction is that, well, here I have a matrix element, which I compute it in the limit that mt goes to zero, or infinity. That matrix element will give me some expression. And I can just match that on to an interaction in the Lagrangian of this form. And by actually computing the one-loop diagram, I fix the coefficient of this interaction to be this. So if I compute, for example, the matrix element for this process, it should give you exactly the same matrix element that we computed here. So the statement of the low energy theorem is that this is actually just equal to 1 half times the top contribution to the beta function divided by alpha s times the VEV, h times trace g mu nu, g mu nu. So this is a statement of the theorem, that this coefficient is actually just related to the coefficient of the beta function. So again, you can just plug in. I could just compute that coefficient, plug it in here, and I got exactly the same answer as what I got by explicitly computing it using the one-loop diagram. It's a very useful theorem for the reason that it's a lot easier to compute the beta function term compared to the whole one-loop calculation of Higgs to glue-glue. For Higgs to glue-glue, we had to compute like the finite contributions to these integrals. For the beta function, you only need to compute the divergent part of the integral.
Is the theorem hold for all the
No, it doesn't. So there's additional corrections once you include higher order stuff.
Just like that one loop?
Yeah, just that one loop, it's true. But then it's modified. I think it's modified just in ways that depend on renormalization group coefficients. So I think you also have to modify it using the anomalous dimension as well of the mass of this thing that's appearing in here. So so that it is modified at higher loop order. That's right. Let me also write down. So this is just a statement of the theorem. And then you can also do it the same thing for the photon. So we can have h to two photons. We can also represent as an effective interaction. So L effective would just be 1/4 beta E over alpha H over V F mu nu. So again, I could do exactly the same exercise for the photon. And again, that coefficient as well is determined just in terms of the beta function. But it's only the contributions of the beta function which are massive. So it's not all of the contributions of the beta function. It's only the ones that are massive that would contribute to this one-loop diagram that we computed. So for the case of the gluon, you would compute just the top contribution of the beta function. And for the case of the photon, it's slightly different. You have not just the top, but you also have the electroweak gauge boson, specifically the W, and just the W, plus minus. OK. So we'll pick up with this on Monday. But I just want to state it for you. And then we'll show that it's true.
Do you have any questions?